and welcome to Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Emily Peck of Axios, and I'm here with Elizabeth Spires of the New York Times. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hello.
And in for Felix Salmon is the wonderful Anna Szymanski of Reuters. Hey, Anna.
Hello.
So today on the show, we bring you much wow. We are talking about DOGE. That is the acronym for the Trump administration's new Department of Government Efficiency. We will talk about that, and we will talk about DOGE, the cryptocurrency, as well, because we're also going to get into the comeback of crypto that's apparently underway, what's driving Bitcoin to all-time highs. And finally, we're going to talk about AI clones. You can use them now for dating. You can use them now to apply to jobs. And we discuss, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Also, we may reenact some dialogue from AI clone virtual dating texts. So you want to stick around for that. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
This week, President-elect Donald Trump, which I still need to get used to saying, announced that Elon Musk, billionaire, best bud to Trump, and regular rich person Vivek Ramaswamy, who also was at some point running for president, will lead what they're calling a Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE for short. And we'll talk about sort of the DOGE cryptocurrency aspect of this in the next segment. But first, let's just take this proposal, the Department of Government Efficiency, which isn't actually going to be a department in the conventional sense, like an agency of the federal government. Let's just discuss it, take it on its own terms. The idea here is these two guys will lead a department and they'll slash and burn the federal government. They're aiming to cut $2 trillion, I guess, from the federal budget and get it done in time for July 4th, 2026. And I just want to make clear just how ginormous the federal government in fiscal year 2023, the federal government spent $6.2 trillion. That's nearly a quarter of GDP. It was a lot more money than the revenue coming in. The federal government employs about 4 million people. Nearly a quarter goes to Social Security. Another quarter to Medicare, Medicaid, 15% to defense, another 10% is interest on the debt. So in other words, a lot of the money in the budget is being spent on things that Americans really like, Social Security checks and health insurance. This is a tough task. Elizabeth, do you think that, two questions. I mean, is this something that needs to be done? Do we need to cut the slack in the federal budget? Is there a lot of government waste and inefficiency? And do you think that this department will succeed in its mission? Like, let's just like take it a little bit seriously. Like, is this a good idea? A, B, are these the right people to carry out the task?
Okay, so there are precedents for doing something like this. During the Clinton years, there was a thing called the National Partnership for Reinventing Government, and it didn't work like this. I had talked to Lane Kmark, who's now at Brookings, and she had worked on it. And she told me that the thing about it was, you know, they sort of made little incremental changes and they did end up saving some money and cutting out some waste. But it was a partnership that was mostly run by people who had worked in the government and therefore understand how it operates and, you know, why you need certain things. And Jared Kushner tried to replicate this during the first Trump administration with something called the Office of American Innovation that mysteriously disappeared a few months in. It seemed to be a kind of vanity project for getting together a bunch of billionaires in the same room. So this sounds more like the latter, except because it's not technically a government department. Congress would have to approve that. It's more like a sort of vanity advisory commission. And when you listen to what they actually want to do, it's similar to Jared's thing in the sense that they seem to be bent on this kind of nihilistic cost cutting without really understanding what they're cutting. So Elon somewhere landed on the number 27%. And it sounds like one of those, I haven't really thought about it numbers, but if they don't make it a rounded number, it sounds more authentic. And Ramaswamy said he wants to fire 75% of the federal work staff, which is crazy. Also an arbitrary number. So it seems like they mostly want to do this because it allows them to wear both hats. They're not held accountable the way that they would be if they were in a real government agency. But you know, if they go abroad and they want to meet with some prime minister of a country, they'll be treated as if they're part of the American government. So for them, it's probably hugely beneficial, but I think it's just very silly in terms of expecting that they'll be able to do anything.
But Anna, there's this thing of, I mean, Elizabeth talked about, you know, in the Clinton administration, it was government insiders who knew where the fat was, presumably cutting the fat. And now with these two guys, they're outsiders. And there is this like notion, I think in business too, where it's like, you bring in the outsiders, you bring in the consultants, and they'll see clear-eyed where the inefficiencies are. Is that what we're going to see?
Well, it's interesting because that is something that has been done in business for a while. And what often ends up happening is that the consultants get paid a lot of money and the business does not actually end up in a better position. So I think that is the concern here. Not necessarily that we're going to be paying these two a lot, but that they may benefit more from it than the United States does. I think that's a fairly safe assumption. I think it's reasonable to say that every administration should be looking for ways to make the government more efficient. I mean, I think one of the issues you have with the government is when you don't have the market as a moderating force, inefficiencies can grow because something might not be working, but if there isn't a reason that you have to get rid of it, then you just keep throwing money at it. It's reasonable. I don't think you need to believe that the government, you know, needs to be drowned in a bathtub in order to believe that there are ways to find efficiencies. The question is just when you start talking about these slightly ridiculous numbers and when you're dealing with people who just aren't serious people, because I think it is reasonable to say that, you know, if you went through, even if you're talking about entitlement spending isn't just the money that, you know, literally you can't touch, it has to go out, but I'm sure there's administration related to Social Security and that you know, maybe you could trim back some of that. I imagine, again, almost every department, you could probably trim little bits here and potentially make it a leaner and more efficient government. But Elizabeth, what you were saying before, like, it needs to be done in a more orderly fashion. I think the idea that you're going to do slash and burn, it's going to end well, just where is the precedent for that? Like, in general, I like to say, please show me an example of where that's happened and it's worked well. If you can't, then I'm going to be slightly suspicious.
Well, part of this is, you know, there's a movement on the right for smaller government, but smaller government just for the sake of being smaller, you know?
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of analysis that goes into it. So, you know, I agree with Anna. I think the analogy is kind of, this is like McKinsey, but run by two edgelords, you know? Trump said it was the Manhattan Project of this era. And that raises a question to me.
Who are we bombing?
What exactly Trump thinks the Manhattan Project was?
He's like, that's how they built Manhattan, right?
Make Manhattan great again. Exactly.
He means like we're bombing the federal government? And the best faith reading of this.
Referring to one of the most expensive government projects in history.
Yeah, it's like inflation adjusted like $40 billion or something. That was how much it cost.
And it employed like 150,000 people too.
If you think the government is useless, then you wouldn't bring up the Manhattan Project as an example. That's a good point that Anna raises about cost cutting. Elizabeth, you had a great piece from the first Trump administration about the failed Jared Kushner effort at this. You said nihilistic cost cutting designed to project the optics of efficiency. And it does seem like it's such a business Jack Welch vibe of like, we will fire people and that is how we will grow. And it's like, no, you grow by adding. You don't grow by subtracting. You know, you don't thrive by cutting, usually.
Yeah. And the context for this was that I worked for Jared. I was the editor-in-chief of the New York Observer when he was still ostensibly a Democrat. And whenever I came in, the Observer never had a profitable quarter. So one of my objectives was to, you know, help get it to profitability and grow the publication. So we did. We had the first profitable quarter in its history. And Jared's reaction to that was, well, the margins would be better if we fire a bunch of people. because he didn't seem to understand that, you know, the amount of stuff we were producing was what we sold ads against and what we sold subscriptions against. And then we would have less inventory, you know, less revenue. He could only imagine this one strategy. And that sounds a lot like what Elon and Vivek want to do. But also one of the more amusing details to me is that Elon is on social media saying that he wants to only staff, quote unquote, high IQ people who are willing to work 80 hours a week for free. And it seems like by definition, if you're willing to work 80 hours a week for free, you're definitely not a high IQ person. So.
No, not the high IQ move.
Elizabeth, one of the things you said there just kind of resonated with me, because I do think this idea of there only being one solution to every problem. And I think what you're seeing both in business and with this effort is a strategy that may have made sense 40 years ago. There was a period of time, especially talking about like the 70s, where the government was massively bloated and they did really need to reduce the size or to find ways to find efficiencies.
Yeah.
In the same way that there is a period of time where you had these enormous, you know, conglomerates that were totally wasteful. And you frankly could make a decent amount of money by just going in, cutting the nonsense, selling it to someone else for a lot more. The problem is that only works when that fat exists. If it's not, and you're cutting into muscle, then you're not going to get the same result. And it seems like people both in politics and often in business just haven't quite learned that.
I think the easiest business skill to learn is honestly cost cutting. And so there are people who can only do that. So the much more difficult aspects of management and restructuring, they just don't know how to do. Mm-hmm. And so it particularly strikes me, you know, Elon did this with Twitter. He just came in before he even knew really what people were doing at the company and laid off a bunch of people and then realized that he needed some of them and tried to hire them back. And so it just seems like this is going to be a redo. But also, you know, during the first Trump administration, they did reduce the size of government, but not strategically. They failed to staff it the first time around because they had a completely unprepared transition team. And there's a book that I kept recommending the whole throughout the administration. It was Michael Lewis's The Fifth Risk. And I'll never forgive Lewis for The Blind Side, but The Fifth Risk is a great book. And it's entirely about the way government actually works. And I think Lewis went in to write a book that he thought was going to be about government waste and inefficiency. And then he ended up spending a lot of time with these agency people as the Trump team was trying to staff these places. And he saw how much chaos it was causing. And he also sort of learned what these agencies do and ended up, you know, I think unintentionally writing a pretty good defense of the way a lot of this stuff works. And I think it's even probably more relevant now because I think this administration is going to be a lot more chaotic.
Yeah. And you have to wonder if the other thing that the incoming Trump administration is doing by saying, you know, we're going to cut all this money out of the budget, we're going to fire all these people, is just trying to get the quote unquote deep state in line. What's more terrifying as an employee? You hear a new boss is coming in and wants to do a lot of firing. And you know, the new boss, you know, prizes loyalty, prizes XYZ, and you want to keep your job. Like you're gonna put your head down and get to work 9 times out of 10. I know there's people inside the government, and I read The Fifth Risk too, that are really devoted to what they do and won't respond like that. But like part of what's going on surely is, you know, get ready for the new guy because he wants you to be loyal and
yeah. Also, the way Trump defines the deep state is basically the deep state is anybody who criticizes him.
Well, yeah.
And any kind of continuous civil service employee, which, you know, we need those people. We can't turn over the entire government every 4 years.
Right.
And I think the people just don't think about that.
And this whole discussion and this whole new quasi department is just another example of not actually dealing with the real problem. The real problem is that entitlements and the interest are, you know, unsustainable, and that you actually, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans or some combination of the two, at some point you are going to have to deal with this, but that's hard. That's going to involve doing things that upset a lot of people and upset a lot of people who vote, by which I mean older people. So no one wants to do that. So they're going to do these performative measures. Again, there's no way that I don't think mathematically, I mean, technically, I'm sure mathematically you could get to 2 trillion, but I don't entirely see how that happens. But regardless, it's not serious. It's not dealing with the actual problem. My guess is, if I had to bet, Ramaswamy is going to be out in 6 weeks. I would say, I don't know, the over and under, you know, Elon, maybe 2 months. Like, how long do we really think that the all of these three egos are going to be able to interact with each other for longer than a few weeks? I think is unlikely. So
yeah. Are we measuring this in heads of lettuce or Scaramucci? Because
Scaramucci seems the appropriate metric, I think.
Yeah, I don't think Trump and Elon in particular are going to last very long because both of them need to be in the spotlight constantly. And Trump gets very angry when he gets eclipsed by anybody.
I don't know. I'm going to take the over. I don't know how to gambling word. I'm going to take blah, 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 gambling word and say that Elon's going to last for a while. I hear people saying, you know, the egos can't da da da. But I think they both made bets on each other and they're not going to walk away so soon.
Apple Card is the perfect card for your holiday shopping. You'll earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Apply now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Subject to credit approval, Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Elizabeth, I wanted to talk to you about something really important, about money. So one of the big challenges people face about money is how much to spend, how much to save. You want financial security. You also want to like live your life. How do you balance that yourself? I know it's kind of a big.
Okay, so this is just my personal feeling. I think it helps to not actually have to think about money or to not have to dwell on it as much as people really do. And, you know, there are some ways to do that and that are not just completely ignoring every financial need you have. But the biggest thing is just trying to allocate and balance your budget in a way that you can automate as many things as possible. And you don't necessarily have to keep going back and looking at, you know, your balances in order to figure out, you know, what you have and what you don't have. It's just people are tempted to do that. They think there's a little bit of a, if I watch the pot, it will boil faster in terms of managing money. But we all know, at least academically, that that's not the case. So in my case, also another thing is just to put savings into places that don't require active management. And that's what most people probably should do anyway, but keeps you from constantly checking your 401k or checking your accounts.
Yeah, I think I basically agree with you, like set it and forget it. I mean, what we do in our home is we have a budget. And so what's nice about that is like, you know how much money you have to spend on various things. And it's sort of gives you the like peace of mind to go ahead and like spend money on fun stuff, going out to eat, travel, whatever, you know, like, oh, I set aside this much money and that's how much it costs and I'm going to pay that and like have fun. And then on the other side, when something like bad happens and, you know, homeowners know that something bad is always happening, you're like, okay, well, we have a fund for exactly this reason. Like, okay, we're going to pay the plumber X amount of dollars and it's fine because we set aside the money for it. Or, you know, when tax season comes and it's like, oh, we owe this much money. Okay, fine. We saved it up because we like allocate it in the budget. So I guess not exactly like your plan, which I feel like is more chill, but it's chill adjacent.
I'm all for chill adjacent financial planning.
Anna, what's going on with crypto right now?
So this week we saw Bitcoin eclipse $90,000. And it is up, I believe, as much as 30% since just the day of the election. And I believe this year alone, it's, you know, more than doubled. So we've just seen incredible appreciation that doesn't seem to be, on the one hand, connected to anything, but on the other hand, makes a tremendous amount of sense if you think that what really is driving this is politics and government regulations, in the sense that what happened with a Trump presidency was people thinking like, okay, there's now going to be much less regulation on Bitcoin. You might have more products like, you know, there's a Bitcoin ETF. You might have the advancement of more products like that. And that is, I think, quite clearly what is driving this beyond simply sentiment and momentum.
Even before Trump was elected, Bitcoin prices were up and crypto was doing well. We wrote about it a bit in Axios Markets and we identified three reasons. Launch of the Bitcoin ETFs conferred some legitimacy, I think, on Bitcoin at least, and there was a halo on some other cryptocurrencies. It brought in institutional investors. There's like $70 billion in these things now. Then there's also these three PACs, Fairshake, that put a lot of money into the election and Fairshake was backed by big crypto companies, and they picked winners and losers in the election, and they picked pretty well. I think Sherrod Brown, partly the Democratic senator from Ohio, who lost his bid for re-election. Part of that was this crypto money. And then the third, of course, is Trump, who, you know, really changes tune during the campaign about crypto. He spoke at a crypto conference. He said he wanted the U.S. to be the crypto capital of the planet. And he wants to create a Bitcoin strategic reserve. And they want to, it's not even that they want to do deregulation. They want to actually do some kind of regulation, pass some laws to make it, to confer more legitimacy, I think, on crypto. And then, you know, he wins and that just sends everything to the moon.
This is what's funny to me about this is that one of the, you know, part of the thesis behind Bitcoin is that it's a way to essentially get around the government, the, you know, people who are concerned about fiat currency, but it is entirely being driven by government policies, which, would seem to somewhat undermine that that thesis.
Elizabeth, first, does any of this surprise you? Did the crypto money come up in like your work in consulting at all?
A little bit, but mostly it came up when all of these Silicon Valley guys banded together and made a big deal about endorsing Trump. So that Mark Andreessen, Mark Pincus, Ben Horowitz, although he reversed himself a little bit and gave a bunch of money to Harris. And I'm not sure if, I think some of their money went into the PAC you mentioned. So Mark Andreessen has been, since the election, every day kind of crowing that he's much happier now. And I think, you know, we saw it there because a lot of the people that I work with, there is some overlap in the tech donor base. But I'm not sure people who are doing, you know, every day on the ground down ballot races would have seen it.
Anna, do you think this lasts?
So this is an interesting question. Because on the one hand, if you look at what's happened with crypto, and the really big move has been since the pandemic, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I might be off on this number, but I think it took 10 years for it to get to 20,000, and then it got to 40,000 in like a month. And then, you know, I know when interest rates started going up, it went down. But again, look at a chart. Really what we're seeing is this push from the pandemic. And I think this has to do with partly the stimulus payments and all that, but it also has to do with the ease of trading. It has to do with momentum. It has to do with a lot of these things. If you look at a chart, and you look at gold and you look at Bitcoin, it is very clear that there is, you know, no correlation whatsoever. Like this, any idea that this is any type of store of value, that this is any type of digital gold makes absolutely no sense.
So not a fear, uncertainty and doubt kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely not. And then, so you say, okay, well, it's obviously not going to be used as a currency in the sense that if I am holding Bitcoin because I think it's going to rapidly appreciate in value, I'm not going to buy a pizza with it. That doesn't make any sense. I guess for me, it's you start working through all of these things, and I just have a hard time landing on an answer of what can justify this rise beyond the simple thing that you think you will be able to sell it in the future to someone else for more.
Isn't that kind of the fundamental policy conflict that it operates sort of like a security?
The issue, though, the difference between Bitcoin and, I mean, lots of things are securities, but say compare it to something like, you know, an equity or a bond, is that there are cash flows behind that. There's a company behind that, you know, and even if you're talking about traditional commodities, there is a physical market for that commodity. There's a financial market for that commodity. Bitcoin, at this point, I still have a very hard time understanding what the real thesis is. And when people who are really into crypto try to explain it to me, they tend to use a lot of words that I don't understand, which makes me very suspicious that they also have no clue what they're talking about. But having said all of that, bubbles can last for a really long time. And I think this is an interesting thing because especially if interest rates continue to come down and all risk assets continue to do relatively well, you could see Bitcoin continuing to do reasonably well, even if there's absolutely nothing whatsoever to underlie it. The question becomes, what is the thing that pushes people to sell? And if that did happen, then of course you could see rapid selling because again, there's fundamentally nothing underneath it. But when does that happen? It could happen next week. It could happen 10 years from now. And if it happens 10 years from now, then you also have that question of the difference between being wrong and being very early. There is no difference. So I guess that's where I've been, like many people, confused about crypto and the rise of crypto since the pandemic. But it's tough when something just keeps going to point out what is the thing that's going to happen that is going to pop this bubble.
I think what we've seen since the pandemic, and we've talked about it a lot in the podcast over the past few years, is just the rise of meme stocks,
yep,
meme coins. I mean, we can talk about Dogecoin too. The price has gone up a lot since Trump announced a Doge department. There's nothing fundamental about that. There's nothing cash flow related about that. It's just, as Matt Levine pointed out this week, it's just like Dogecoin got more attention. So more people started buying it and trading it because attention brings price increases. And it may not seem rational, but it is rational for traders to trade on Bitcoin and crypto if the price keeps going up. And if the guy that just got elected, our first meme president, is a booster and a backer. I mean, it's at some point, it's like, this is just how things are going to go for a while, I think. If the FTX scandal didn't break Bitcoin, it's hard to imagine what would.
Also, I think Bitcoin operates a little bit differently from the rest of the crypto market. And I don't think that they could become totally decoupled, but you know, Bitcoin is taken a lot more seriously than a lot of the other things. And it seems like its performance is not wholly contingent upon whatever's happening in the rest of crypto necessarily.
It just, all of it seems to hinge on belief, and people's beliefs about this stuff get stronger with all the momentum behind it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the classic of what happens in a bubble. And to be fair, much of finance is based on belief. Like, one could argue that money itself is fundamentally based on belief. There's a reason that the word credit comes from the word to believe. What always happens with this kind of thing is that bubbles, they sometimes have waves. And then once you get towards the end, you will even have reasonable people who will often start to glom on because they're like, clearly there must be something here. Clearly, you know, and people always think that they'll get out in time. That's the other classic thing with any type of bubble. You always assume that you'll know, you'll sell out in time. But to me personally, if there was something that were to actually stop Bitcoin's rise, I would think it would just be going back to my favorite thing in the world. It's just interest rates. If interest rates land, the terminal rate ends up being a lot higher than it was in the past, and by which I mean a lot higher, basically where it is now. If it doesn't go down significantly, if it kind of ends up in a range like 3-4%, that is a very different world in terms of how less money is going to get thrown towards stupid things in a world where money has a cost.
But the price of Bitcoin is going up now in a high rate environment.
Right. No, but it's going up in an environment where people assume rates are coming down. The thing with interest rates is it's much more important what people think about what's going to happen with them as opposed to what's literally happening with them. So because people think we are going to be in an environment where it's, so that's where that makes sense. Now, of course, in recent weeks, we have seen a move in treasuries that isn't being replicated in Bitcoin, but I would argue that is very much because of the election. I would imagine that over time, if it becomes clear that we are truly in a new era, money is truly actually going to be priced again, I could see over time seeing Bitcoin kind of slowly fall and then one day just collapse.
You heard it here, folks. So, Anna is bearish on crypto. The only
Please send
one
all of your
left.
Angry emails to me about how I'm just a silly woman who does not understand the genius of crypto.
Don't people gamble and trade on things that have quote unquote no value all the time? Like, what is sports betting? There's no value there, but there is value there because people are willing to spend money making trades, right?
In theory, that's the difference between betting and investing. I realize people will argue that there actually isn't, but no, exactly. If you're saying, I am studying the fundamentals of this company, I think that this security is going to be worth more in the future because of how I think these cash flows are going to grow, then that is an investment. Of course, there's a level of chance there in the same sense that there is with betting, but betting is just, it's for fun, essentially. It's not because you're, you know, this is not an investment decision. And I would probably argue that much of the crypto world does seem to be more in line with the betting world than traditional investment.
Yeah. And a lot of the market is, I mean, you already conceded this, but is betting. I mean, derivative trading, that's betting. If you're only holding a stock for a little while, you're not like, I really believe in this company. You're like, I think the price is going up or down.
Speculation instead of investment.
And it's tricky here too, because like when it comes to—
Fits right in.
Yeah. When it comes to derivatives too, you kind of need somebody speculating in order to have somebody to be able to hedge. Like the system only works if you have both sides of that. So having some speculators actually is not a bad thing. And derivatives are, you know, there are very logical reasons why people use derivatives. Also, you know, in theory, you could also make the argument that you are still making an investment decision, even if you're holding something for a short period of time, because it is based on, if it's based on analysis, if it's based on what's happening in markets, it's not simply a a wild guess. But fundamentally, I would agree with you that I think many short-term investment strategies have quite a bit in common with gambling.
Okay. Our email is slatemoney@slate.com. So you can send all your crypto thoughts to us and we will make sure Anna sees them. This episode is brought to you by GiveWell. You like to optimize things. You've chosen the perfect credit card to maximize your travel points, and you always find the fastest route when you drive. Shouldn't you handle your charitable giving the same way? GiveWell spends 50,000 hours every year doing deep dives into different charitable programs to help you do the most good for your dollar. GiveWell has now spent over 17 years researching charitable organizations and only directs funding to a few of the highest impact opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $2 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save over 200,000 lives and improve the lives of millions more. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. All of their research and recommendations are available on their site for free. You can make tax-deductible donations to their recommended funds or charities, and GiveWell doesn't take a cut. Go to givewell.org to find out more and make a donation. Select podcasts and enter Slate Money at checkout to make sure they know you heard about them from us. Again, that's givewell.org to donate or find out more. This episode is brought to you by public.com. Interest rates have fallen, but you can still lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account at public.com. That's a pretty big deal because when rates drop, so can the interest you earn on your investment. A bond account allows you to lock in a 6% or higher yield with a diversified portfolio of high yield and investment grade corporate bonds. So, while other people are watching their return shrink, you could be earning regular interest payments. But a yield is not locked in until you invest, so check it out. The good news is it only takes a couple of minutes to sign up at public.com. Lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account, only at public.com/slatemoney. Brought to you by Public Investing, member FINRA and SIPC. As of September 26, 2024, the average annualized yield to worst across the bond account is greater than 6%. Yield to worst is not guaranteed. Non-investment recommendation. All investing involves risk. Visit public.com/disclosures/bond-account for more info. Let's talk about AI clones. So Elizabeth spotted this great piece in the New York Times where a reporter, a young tech reporter, decided to use these dating apps that let you effectively create a clone of yourself that then goes out and interacts with either a real live human or another AI clone to sort of screen ahead of deciding whether or not you will go on a date. And I thought to show the listeners just how this goes, what would be most efficient would be for Elizabeth and I to just reenact a conversation that took place between the reporter. I don't have his name in front of me.
It's a reporter's clone and yes, is presumably an actual human.
Yes, the reporter's name is Eli. So it's Eli's clone and the human is Rachel. And I will, for this, take the part of Eli's clone. So Eli's clone says to Rachel, "If you could only eat one snack for the rest of your life, what would it be?"
And Rachel says, "Mozzarella sticks."
"Crunchy cheese bliss! What is it about mozzarella sticks that makes your heart skip a beat?"
"LOL, it gives pizza vibes, but with much more cheese. What's your go-to?"
"Expensive cheese and bread all the way. There's something about the richness that makes my heart sing. What's your fave pizza topping, BTW?"
"Pepperoni. And what do you mean, expensive cheese?"
"Pepperoni perfection."
This is like if a Disney tween movie was trying to reenact a dating scene and it all had to be totally rated G. But the reporter compares this to like talking to a customer service chatbot. So.
Yes.
It's so unsurprising that at the end of the column, Eli, the reporter, is like, "This did not lead me down the path of romance. I did not find love by setting my clone out into the world to find romance."
Anna, my clone was super cringe.
It's so cringe. Also, mozzarella sticks is the one snack I just, even Rachel is letting me down, the human.
It's a strange choice.
There's a great line from the reporter where he used another clone, and it said, he's describing the clone, and it said, it had favorite coffee shops and hobbies different from the ones that I trained it on. It loved emojis and expressed a deep interest in the Beatles, always looking to introduce its dates to a little known album called Abbey Road.
Fun fact, I live very close to Abbey Road.
Oh. Do you guys think that dating bots, AI clones are the business of the future? What's going on, Anna?
I mean, to be fair, dating is such a mess in general that I'm like, is this really that much worse? I don't know. But I have a hard time believing that this is going to take off, but who knows? I it does seem right now like we're in a moment very similar, you know, to the 90s where you have this AI, it's an important new technology, but people don't really know exactly how it's going to be used in the future in the same sense that when the internet was first developed, people really didn't know, or when the internet was first popularized, people didn't really know how it was going to develop. And so my guess is we are going to get an increasing number of these extremely silly things that at some point will all be washed away, and then AI will actually change the world with real companies.
I thought about this because at the beginning, at the dawn of the internet, the thing everyone made fun of was pets.com. Yeah, where you could order pet food online. And everyone, after that company failed for like a decade, people were like, and the .com bubble and pets.com, and it's so dumb. Well, now here we are in 2024, and Chewy, which delivers pet food online, is a thriving business that a lot of the pet owners I know use. So it's possible that 20 years from now, everyone will be meeting everyone, their romantic partners and their life partners through AI clones. Who knows? Right, Elizabeth?
I think, you know, part of the problem is we're in the middle of like an AI hype cycle. So some of this is just, you know, I have an AI hammer, everything's a nail. But we also talked a little bit in the prep about AIs being used for recruitment. People are having, you know, ChatGPT write their resumes and stuff, and, you know, they would automate sending them out, and they'd have clones that are essentially, you know, acting as, I guess, recruiters for people looking for jobs. And what strikes me is that these companies are trying to use AI to do things that are kind of labor intensive for people and that are really just, you know, filtering processes.
Yeah.
So, which is kind of what dating is in a way, and you know, applying for jobs and things like that. But they're not, the clones are not, because they are mostly large language models, they don't have any specific, you know, real intelligence. And so you get the same responses that you would get if you engage with any kind of AI bot. You get these slightly weird, uncanny valley conversations because we don't have artificial general intelligence yet. You know, the bots can't really respond like normal humans.
It's actually interesting because the reason you have to filter, employers have to filter job applications and job hunters have to resort to AI to help them write job applications is because technology has flooded the zone with job applications. It's technology has made it easier for more people to apply to jobs and made it easier for companies to screen, you know, hundreds of applications. So now there's like kind of like a backlash of technology being used to deal with the problem that technology caused.
Yeah. And to be fair, when people are dating or when people are trying to find a job, one of the things they often say is it feels like a part-time job, that there is actually a lot of weird legwork involved in both of these things. And I think it's reasonable to say that some of this maybe could be done by AI in the future. I mean, especially when you're talking about applying for jobs. I was actually thinking about this, you know, right now, the system is really not great for figuring out, you know, if someone has transferable skills where they're working in one industry, but actually maybe working in this other industry could make a lot of sense. And right now we really have no way to connect those things. And you never know, maybe as, you know, these types of technologies, which are very good at, you know, filtering and pattern recognition could be used for something like that in the future. Or, you know, creating a cover letter, which I mean, I think we should just get rid of cover letters, but or even creating a resume itself. Like this is a process that does seem like it could simply be done by AI. There's no real skill involved there. Now, when you start to get into the actual interview or say an actual date, then yeah, it seems like a human should probably be there.
I definitely agree with you, Anna, when I was thinking about especially the job application process, just like, of course you should use AI to help you write a resume or a cover letter. I mean, you shouldn't just blindly have AI write your resume and cover letter and send it off. You should, you know, then read it over and edit it. But it sometimes feels like that's a a mentally very big hurdle to just sit down and write the cover letter or mm-hmm. write the job application. So it seems great to have that help. And there's some data in this piece in the Financial Times that sort of inspired our segment that 57% of Gen Z are using AI to write job applications, but only 21% of Gen X and 13% of boomers. So I think, yeah, I think it's like a natural use case because also different from dating, who cares if you're not sincere in your job application? Like, you know what I mean? Like, just say whatever you need to say.
No one is actually sincere.
Right. You're not yourself. Don't be yourself. So if you guys were dating right now, I don't think either of you are, but would you go the AI bot route?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, definitely not. But I will say, I sometimes think about definitely it, like not. The randomness involved in online dating of just like my boyfriend who like, I almost didn't swipe on him. I just was like, eh, I'm not sure, maybe. And you know, 4 years later now, we're still together. And so it does make you think, man, humans, we're not very good at this stuff, are we?
Yeah, why not have a little help from technology? Maybe Abbey Road is the key to a successful dating life. And it took an AI bot to discover it for us.
I'm waiting for the AI bots to start talking about Burning Man, though. Then we know that the machines are taking over.
Apple Card is the perfect card for your holiday shopping. When you use Apple Card on your iPhone, you'll earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, including products at Apple, like a new iPhone 16 or Apple Watch Ultra. Apply now in the Wallet app on your iPhone. Subject to credit approval, Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Terms and more at applecard.com. This episode is brought to you by Glean. AI has the potential to help everyone be more efficient at work, but only if it deeply understands the data, people, processes, and context specific to your work. That's exactly what Glean's Work AI platform does. Glean starts by connecting and understanding all your company data across the apps you use every day. Glean's powerful AI assistant helps you find answers, generate content, and automate work. With Glean's search and workhub capabilities, employees can find everything they need to know to do their best work and stay aligned. Glean has solutions for all types of teams, from customer support and engineering to sales and HR. Hundreds of enterprises, including some of the world's leading technology, telecom, retail, manufacturing, and banking businesses, put AI to work with Glean. Visit glean.com/slatemoney for information on how you can receive 15% off your first year. That's glean.com/slatemoney for 15% off. Glean, work AI for all. We have a numbers round to do. I'm going to go first because you guys are stunning me lately with your numbers. So I don't want to leave mine for last. I want a showstopper. I'm hoping for a showstopper again. My number is 141,839. That's dollars. $141,839 that was spent by three insurance companies in California to pay out claims from these guys who said a bear had entered their Rolls-Royce car, and also other men said a Mercedes cars, that a bear had entered the car when it was parked in the San Bernardino Mountains and did a lot of damage to the inside of the car. They even provided video footage of the bear in the car. But the authorities figured out this was a scam. It turns out the bear was just a person in a bear costume. You can watch the video online, and it kind of, at some point, the bear kind of turns from the front seat to the back seat. And the way it turns, you can kind of see the fabric of the costume. But they didn't just use amateur eyes on the video. They actually brought in a biologist to review the bear videos. But in the end, also concluded that the bears in San Bernardino are typically black bears. The costume was brown fur. So it all kind of went paws up, I guess.
That's very analog. I thought that you were going to say it was AI. It was an AI-generated bear.
That's next level. But I guess they needed the person in the bear costume to do the... I guess the damage was already there. I don't know, man. This was a scam. They pulled two Mercedes and a Rolls Royce. I mean, if you can afford
this
a Rolls Royce,
complicated,
what are you doing?
Yeah. Who thought of the scam? Also, I just imagine the biologist sort of peering at the video and saying, bears don't have that posture.
A bear movement would be more, yes.
They're like, the bear is checking its phone, clearly.
We barely scratched the surface. Elizabeth?
Okay, my number is 13, and that's percent. And there's a study that says women have 13% less free time than men. And this was taken from a Times article about how there's a fitness gender gap. 33% of women meet the weekly recommendation for aerobic exercise and 43% of men do. And the explanation is that women devote more time and labor to caring for home and others. And they tend to construct their schedules around obligations to other people. And men are more likely to construct their schedules around the things that they want to do for leisure time and personal priorities.
I mean, that's what you need to do. You got to prioritize what you want to do, I think. I mean, I know it's hard. It's really hard for women who have to care for children and sometimes other family members to do that. But if you want to prioritize fitness, you have to literally do that.
It's funny because I run, I've read a lot of books of people who've done, you know, people are really great in ultras and all these different things. And it's so funny because with the guys, it's always, they just never mention it is so clear that their wife is doing everything. And it is a very common theme in that particular genre.
I have someone around here who is a marathon runner, and they solve this by just like getting up at like 4:30 in the morning when it's still dark and the kids are sleeping to get the run in. And it's just, that's rough. That's rough.
I will say I do for marathon training, actually, even though I do not have kids, I always do it super early in the morning just because it's a huge, well, partly because I also don't like the sun, but it's a huge chunk of time. And I just find it's, especially once you get into the really like your 18, 20 mile runs, I just like doing those early. So I get that.
Do we need to talk? Is Anna a vampire? What is this? You don't like the sun?
I have very sensitive eyes. I don't like too much sun.
Okay.
Like
I agreed to do a turkey trot in 2 weeks, and this conversation is just making me exhausted.
My number is 7,943, and that is a percent. So on the theme of government inefficiency, apparently, Boeing marked up laboratory soap dispensers by 7,943% in terms of what it charged the U.S. Air Force. Now, to be fair, the actual amount of money that this resulted in was not huge, but it was just a pretty amazing example of A, government inefficiency, B, Boeing being fairly awful, and also just wondering that the people had the time to calculate that as well. But interesting story.
Boeing gonna Boeing.
They were AI-powered, gold-plated soap.
Exactly. Boeing was like, oh, but you know, the government had these, you know, really strict specifications in terms of, I'm like, there's soap dispensers.
Strict specifications.
No topical poison in the soap.
Okay, that's it for our show today. If you have thoughts or comments, soap recommendations, thoughts on cover letters, or I guess crypto, send them to slatemoney@slate.com. If you're a Plus member, the fun does not need to end. You can find a special extra segment in your feed right now where we're going to talk about a subject near and dear to my heart, New York City brokers' fees for rental apartments, because they might be over. Thanks to Shana Roth and Jasmine Molly for producing. I'm Emily Peck. And on behalf of Anna Szymanski and Elizabeth Spires, thank you for listening. And we'll see you back here next week on Slate Money.
Save on holiday favorites at Safeway. This week at Safeway, get a free Signature Farms whole frozen turkey, grade A, with a minimum purchase of $150 or more in a single transaction. Member price, limit one offer per household. Plus, get 12 ounces of Oscar Mayer bacon for $3.97 each with digital coupon. Limit four. Also this week at Safeway, Lucerne milk, half gallons, selected varieties are $2.47 each with digital coupon. Limit two. Visit Safeway.com or head in store for more deals.